You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Band. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we talk to our lady in Rio to mull over the significance of this week's Rio 20 Sustainability Conference. I'll also talk to the author of the book The Dictator's Learning Curve about how authoritarianism is becoming more nimble. And we head to the Côte d'Azur to get the latest from the Cannes Lions Conference on Creativity.
The bulk of the people attending Cannes during this week are communications specialists, either in the fields of creativity or marketers or designers, anyone that's really got an interface with people.
Plus, we meet the neighbours. Today, it's the turn of the Atlas Gallery, a photography gallery just around the corner from the doors of our studio right here at Midori House.
We are a gallery specialising exclusively in photography, which includes both fine art photography, photojournalism, fashion. We deal with all aspects, really, of the photographic medium.
We promise we'll wake you up before the rest of that. All that, plus we check in with our man in Buenos Aires and play some music too, all to come here in the next hour on Midori House. But first, let's get the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The trial of Anders Behring Breivik has ended in Norway with a walkout by families of victims. The walkout was staged in protest at his attempts to justify the massacre in which 77 people died last July and more than 240 were injured. As Breivik took the stand, around 30 people left the courtroom. The mother of a survivor and member of the support group, Christine Bjelland, explained why they had decided to leave the room before Breivik's testimony.
Well, it was very moving because we had five testimonies from people that were affected, from different sort of groups of the affected. And we heard every day stories and what they felt, what they experienced. And we feel that that was very correct, that the trial ends with the focus on those who were affected.
Judges will deliver their verdict on the 24th of August. The Turkish government has called an emergency security meeting following reports that one of its fighter jets was shot down by Syrian security forces. Turkish military sources said contact had been lost with an F-4 Phantom over the Mediterranean Sea in an area southwest of Hatay province. The Turkish state news agency reports that the Syrian government has apologized for the incident. Meanwhile, opposition activists in Syria say government troops have killed at least 10 people in the main commercial hub of Aleppo when they opened fire on a crowd of demonstrators. Thousands of people denouncing President Bashar al-Assad were marching towards the city central square when four armoured vehicles are reported to have opened fire. In other developments, international mediator Kofi Annan has warned that the crisis in Syria could soon spiral out of control. He called on the international community to take urgent action.
The longer we wait, the darker Syria's future becomes. This process cannot be open-ended. It is urgent that our consultations yield real results soon. Otherwise, I fear we are reaching the day when it will be too late to stop the crisis from spiraling out of control.
Elite Afghan police and a support team of NATO forces have ended a 12-hour siege at a popular lakeside hotel outside Kabul. It's understood that at least 20 people died after Taliban gunmen stormed the building, bursting into a party and seizing dozens of hostages. Correspondents say the nighttime assault on the hotel, with rocket-propelled grenades, suicide vests and machine guns, has again shown how potent the Islamist insurgency remains after a decade of war. A total of 15 banks and financial institutions have been downgraded by the credit agency Moody's. They include JP Morgan, Citigroup, Royal Bank of Scotland, Societe Generale and Morgan Stanley. Some of the 15 were warned that they could be further downgraded as their governments could withdraw support. Leaders of the Eurozone's four biggest nations have agreed in principle to measures to boost growth equal to 1% of the currency area's economic output. The four, from Germany, Spain, France and Italy, met in Rome ahead of an EU summit on the euro crisis next week. And that's the news here at Monocle 24.
Thanks, James. It's 5 minutes past six here in the UK, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24, Lagatia.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Yorkosan.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle
24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It certainly is, and you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Robert Bounds. Now, today is the final day of the Rio 20 summit. Environmental groups and some politicians, though, are not very happy with how things have ended, declaring the summit a failure. Nonetheless, here's what Hillary Clinton had to say earlier today.
The goal is to reduce short-lived climate pollutants that cause more than 30% of current global warming, as well as millions of premature deaths and extensive crop losses. We believe solutions require action by all of us. Governments, yes. Let's do our part. Let's do more than our part. We know that we will be judged not by what we say, nor even by what we intend to do, but by whether we deliver results for people alive today and whether we keep faith with future generations.
Now, for the latest update on the final leg of the summit, Monocle's Tom Edwards spoke earlier with our lady at the Rio 20, Sheena Rossiter.
So, Sheena, today is the final day of the Rio UN conference. On balance, looking back, would you say that it's been successful, or are we in a situation where nothing's really changed?
I would say that we're kind of in a situation where nothing has really changed that much. Even though they have established a document, they actually finalized a document on June 19th, the day in the middle of the night, the day before the conference actually started on the 20th. And the document reads really, really long. It's supposedly around 293 paragraphs, and it mentions about 16 times sustainable development, because that's been the big buzzword of this conference. A lot of activists have said that not a lot has really changed since the Earth Summit in 1992, and that more really needs to be done. Delegates disagree, however. They're saying that any agreement is a success right now because the global economic turmoil is so bad.
Now, I understand that Hillary Clinton, of course, was speaking today. Barack Obama, one of the high-profile leaders to stay away from the event, but the Secretary of State was there nonetheless. What did she have to say, and what direction did her speech today take?
Yes, so Barack Obama, basically, he didn't show up, and the talk of why he didn't show up is essentially that he's fighting a battle for a very difficult re-election campaign and that the U.S. is in a bit of political turmoil at the moment. Hillary Clinton did mention a few things in her speech. She mentioned some talks about creating more sustainable cities and that was an initiative taken last year between the Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff and the U.S. President Barack Obama. She did also touch on some other points about creating more sustainable stoves and things like that. But the main point in which she made that really struck me personally was she said, and I quote, "The only prosperous and sustainable economy is an inclusive economy," end quote. Basically, one of the main talks that have dominated talks here at the Rio Plus 20 conference is talk of the green economy. And essentially, most people are saying the activists are saying that the green economy is dominating talks, but it's not really, it's kind of doing a bit of greenwash to what should actually be accomplished here. She did also touch on reproductive rights for women. She talked about how women should be able to choose when they want to, you know, reproduce and have that right, because they're a fundamental part of moving forward in a more sustainable way in the future. However, those comments could be controversial among some of the 193 countries that are here, as you can probably imagine.
Now, I wanted to ask you next, Sheena. I mean, for Brazil itself, there's obviously been some feeling of disappointment that some of these high-profile leaders didn't attend. Do you think that the nation looking at this event will feel that it ended on a positive note, or will feelings of frustration be the dominant ones, do you think?
Well, it's kind of hard to say on that one. I would say almost a bit of feelings of frustration in a way, because I did just get a press briefing, which was done by the spokesperson for the United Nations. One of the journalist that was in the audience did ask a question of basically, how much did this conference cost? The response basically was, well, the host country, Brazil, is bearing the brunt of most of those costs. And as you can imagine, you know, Brazil's already up for quite a few costs with the World Cup coming up and the Olympics coming up. You know, also it was quite frustrating for Cariocas, that's local people that live here in Rio de Janeiro, since it did create a massive backlog in traffic for the week leading up to the event.
And Sheena, I know there's been a number of protests in Rio, environmental organisations unhappy about the final solution there. And I've seen coverage, even the Miami Herald today in the United States had a big front page picture of a woman walking through a sort of shanty town with terrible problems with sewage and details about the amount of raw waste that's still pumped out into the oceans, that kind of thing. Do you think, especially with all these big infrastructure projects coming and all the costs associated with them, that there'll be an appetite for, say, Rio plus 25, Rio plus 30?
It's a bit difficult to tell for that. You know, there has been talk from some official delegates here that, that you know, when we look forward for Rio plus 40, etc., you know, how things will change by then. Of course, they hold one of these conferences about every 10 years or so. The original one was the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, and then in 10 years ago, it happened in Johannesburg, and then now it's back again in Rio. You know, it's hard to say. Definitely now that people have more of a voice they did 20 years ago, I would say that if people had a say in it, that there would be definitely less of an appetite to hold a big global conference like this, which was definitely not sustainable because it had to fly delegates from all over the world to Rio.
I just wanted to ask, I mean, in terms of the actual resolutions that we've seen on the table today, I know they've been a long time coming, going through this sort of difficult transition through the conference and then approval. What kind of things are nations committing to? What is expected of the participants there? What kind of measures will need to be put in place for them to deliver on the promises that they have made there?
Well, it's really interesting that you say that, Tom, because the Rio document that is going to be coming out of this conference isn't legally binding. So even though it's going to be put down on paper, it doesn't necessarily mean that any of the countries, 193 countries involved in it, need to actually implement anything. However, Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, did make a lot of comments about renewable energy and more sustainable ways of energy. He's looking at getting that doubled globally by the year 2030. And basically, within this Rio document that's looking to come out, which will be announced here at the end of the day, basically what they're looking to achieve is to replace the Millennium Development Goals with more sustainable development goals. The Millennium Development Goals are set to expire in 2015, so these, what is expected to be achieved here is basically going to fill in for those Millennium Development Goals.
And just finally, Sheena, I wonder, in terms of how the whole Rio Plus 20 event plays out within Brazil, what's the response of the public, both to the event and to its conclusions? And what kind of political capital, if any, will the likes of Mayor Paes and President Rousseff make from the event?
It's definitely brought a lot of attention. I went to one event in particular in a favela here in Rio, where Mayor Michael Bloomberg went around with the mayor of Rio de Janeiro because they were basically implementing more sustainable housing there in the favela. So it definitely brings more attention to Brazil, and it basically reinforces the importance of Brazil in the global economy and the global political sphere.
What is a political sphere? We will wonder. Well, you must write in. You can write any of the email addresses on the Monocle Masthead to find out what a political sphere is. That was Sheena Rossiter. She's got a lovely voice, live from Rio, talking to Tom Edwards. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
What does Mexico make you think of? Drugs, kidnappings, tequila and more drugs? Or how about a thriving economy, innovative business leaders,
world-beating art, and the best in hospitality, and a rather good quality of life. As Mexicans prepare to elect a new president on July the 1st, next week on Monocle 24, we'll be going beyond the headlines and the stereotypes. We'll reveal a nation that international brands are desperate to crack, and where politics is vibrant and vital. We'll also reveal why you should put down that tequila as we investigate the Mezcal revival. Join us for Monocle's week-long Mexican survey on The Globalist and The Daily. Mexico 2012, next week on Monocle 24.
How jaunty Mexico sounds. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Coming up next, we've got the latest from the Cannes Lion Creative Awards. But before that, this is Genesis by Grimes. That was Grimes with Genesis from the album Visions. The time is 18:19 here in London, and we're actually going to go to our man in Buenos Aires before we go to Cannes. You are listening to Midori House. And now we talk to our man in Buenos Aires, Ed Stocker, from the Argentine truckers' strike to plans for the Uruguayan government to nationalise its cannabis market. Welcome, Ed, to Midori House. First up, we should talk about this Paraguayan president Fernando Lugo, who's facing an impeachment trial. This is serious news.
It is indeed, Rob. It's actually taking place right now as we speak, so it's breaking news. Essentially, it's kind of a vote of confidence on his presidency. He's got a very weak power base. He's this sort of quite charismatic, left-leaning leader. It all basically started last week when there was a massacre in the northeast of the country. It was police trying to clear some landless peasants from a private property that basically led to 17 people being killed, both landless peasants and police. And this has kicked off this whole process of impeachment against the president, basically linking him, personally responsible for the actions.
Obviously Lugo is instructing the police. Perhaps people think that as a left-leaning president, he should be on the side of the people.
Well, the strange thing in a way is that he's been very much a supporter of the landless peasants in the country. I mean, the land problems are a big issue in Paraguay. Basically because there was a dictatorship that lasted over 30 years, from the 50s to the late 80s. A lot of land was sold to private companies and landowners. So there are these ongoing disputes. But despite the fact that he's been a big supporter, they're kind of linking him to the problems that are, well, the opposition are linking him to the massacre. So it's a kind of irony in a way. But it's essentially because he leads a coalition, he has a weak power base, and it's all beginning to fall apart.
And so these land disputes, Ed, are these, this is something obviously that was inherited from the dictatorship. Is this sort of something that every Paraguayan president or president tries to solve? Is this a kind of always a big cloud hanging over everyone who owns what and how it gets split up?
Well, to be honest, not really, because Lugo's been is the first sort of, apart from a year in the 30s, he's the first left-leaning president the country's really had, because it's had a very tumultuous history of military dictatorships and right-wing de facto leaders. So he was elected in 2008 with a lot of, hope and anticipation for what might happen, including solving some of the land issues. But the problem is, because of his weak coalition, he's never really been able to follow through with some of those idealistic or hopeful wishes that he had.
And you're watching it live. It's obviously a story that's unfolding in South America right now, Ed. What are people saying the chances of a successful impeachment are? I mean, is he putting himself in the dock as such to prove that he's a fair politician, or is there a chance that it could all go wrong for him genuinely?
I think there's a big chance it could all go wrong for him. It's what some people are calling a sort of democratic coup d'etat, in the sense that, you know, they're going through democratic institutions, and he's determined to make sure, by standing up to the trial, that, you know, democracy wins over, as it were. But as I was saying before, because he's got such a weak power base that's basically crumbled. You know, the two chambers are controlled by the opposition, so it had to pass. This impeachment had to pass the lower house in order to go to the Senate, where it is now. And you know, the vote was about 70-odd to 1 against him. So it shows that, you know, politicians don't support him. So his chances aren't looking great, to be honest with you, which is of course alarming a lot of the left-leaning leaders around the region.
All right, well, let's change the subject. We're going to go back to where you are right now in Argentina. There was a truckers' strike. Now, that sounds like it could be French news. It sounds like I've got sort of an image in my head of kind of lots of people backed up at Calais. What's it? How does it look in Argentina, and what sort of seriousness has that had on the economy?
It's not quite like France. A little bit spicier, perhaps. There was a clash with police not that long ago. The government reacted, I guess, quite a heavy hand to what happened. This is basically the biggest union, a sort of umbrella union in the country called the CGT, supporting the truck drivers who are looking for various improvements in their work conditions, I guess. Including a raise in salaries. They want the income tax level lowered so they don't have to pay as many taxes. And they're looking for welfare breaks as well. So there was a big clash. I mean, essentially, truck drivers and union leaders were blocking refineries so that trucks delivering petrol couldn't leave. So this led to quite a lot of doomsday-type reporting yesterday, basically because it meant that there were shortages of fuel in various parts of the country. But the government actually did back down and has agreed to raise salaries for these truck drivers by about 25% over the next year or so, so in various stages. But the drama is actually set to continue because that's not good enough.
What's the sort of feeling on the street? Do people kind of sympathise with the truck drivers, or do they think, like, God, you know, get on with it? We've all got to, you know, we're all under sort of a bit of a pay freeze at the moment. So are there sympathy for them?
I think people see it for what it is, really. To be honest with you, these disputes in Argentina are often marked by sort of quite, they're very personal. I think more personal than you might get in other parts of the world. In the sense that the leader of the union, Hugo Moyano, used to be the darling of the Kirchners, both Néstor Kirchner and the current president. They've basically had a falling out, and so people get the feeling that this is basically a fight between Moyano and the government, and I guess some, you know, normal people are paying the consequences. I mean, we'll see what happens. There's a general strike called for Wednesday of next week. And we'll see if it all kicks off again then, I guess.
All right. And finally, there's the Uruguayan legalization of cannabis. We're going to have to keep this one quick, Ed, but tell us about that.
It's just been tabled by the government, so it hasn't actually passed. It still has to go to Parliament. This is basically in an attempt to tackle violent crime linked to drugs. They want to legalize marijuana only. This would be basically almost like an Amsterdam or Holland type situation where the state controls the sale of marijuana. This is basically because there's been a lot of violent crime related to Paco, which is a cocaine derivative, and they think if they legalize marijuana, it will take money away from the drugs traffickers. And slightly naively, I think, they think it might convince people to use marijuana instead of harder drugs. But I don't quite see the rationale of that thinking. But it's still a very pioneering move for South America. Lots of countries have much harder policies towards drugs, but we'll have to see what happens.
We will indeed, Ed, and I hope that you've done some experiment in that line yourself, but make sure you clean your suitcase before you come back to the Monocle office. Ed Stocker, as ever, enlightening, live from Buenos Aires. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. In the next half hour, we'll be finding out why Zurich made it to the top spot in our most livable cities guide, and we'll be speaking to the author of The Dictator's Learning Curve about why authoritarianism's clinging on. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The trial of Anders Behring Breivik has ended in Norway with a walkout by families of victims. The walkout was staged in protest at his attempts to justify the massacre in which 77 people died last July and more than 240 were injured. The Turkish government has called an emergency security meeting following reports that one of its fighter jets was shot down by Syrian security forces. Turkish military sources said contact had been lost with an F-4 Phantom over the Mediterranean in an area southwest of Hatay province. In other developments, international mediator Kofi Annan has warned that the crisis in Syria could soon spiral out of control and has called on the international community to take urgent action. Elite forces in Afghanistan and a support team of NATO soldiers have ended a 12-hour siege at a popular lakeside hotel outside Kabul. It's understood that at least 20 people died after Taliban gunmen stormed the building, bursting into a party and seizing dozens of hostages. A total of 15 banks and financial institutions have been downgraded by the credit ratings agency Moody's. They include JP Morgan, Citigroup, Royal Bank of Scotland, Societe Generale and Morgan Stanley. Leaders of the Eurozone's four biggest nations have agreed in principle to measures to boost growth equal to 1% of the currency area's economic output. The four, from Germany, Spain, France and Italy, met in Rome ahead of an EU summit on the euro crisis next week. Those are the headlines from Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. You're listening to Midori House with me, Robert Bound. Now, you might think that after the Arab Spring, dictatorships are old hat. While Houses of Cards fell, Singapore, Belarus, Syria and the classics like Swaziland and North Korea remain dictated to. William Dobson has written a study of how dictatorships have learnt from the fall of the Soviet Union to hone their practice. The Washington-based journalist takes us inside the relentless battle between dictators and the people challenging their rule, focusing on a few illustrative case studies, Russia, China, Venezuela and Egypt. Dobson describes how dictators have adapted to new threats, how they've moved along the learning curve. He joins us now on the line to tell us more about his new book, The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. William, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Now, there's obviously some stuff, some newsworthy stuff happening at the moment, which you might be able to shine some light on, or your book might. The election in Egypt, did that sort of have a shadow cast over it by the former dictatorship?
Considerable shadow. Yes, I mean, if you think about what's going on there now, it's very helpful to sort of imagine or remember what the regime was under Mubarak. If there was a apt label that you could have put on that regime, it's not perfect, but probably closest to accurate would have been a military dictatorship. The military was the backbone of that regime. Every modern Egyptian president has had a military pedigree. The military in Egypt is a more peerless institution than you'll find in almost any authoritarian country in the world. So really, when you think about what happened last year in February 2011 with people rising up in Tahrir Square, the military seized on that as an opportunity not so much to bring forward the revolution, but to answer the question of succession. It had always been a question whether or not it would be Gamal, Mubarak's son, or another military general. The military is clearly giving the indication that they want to continue to have control.
And can you tell, I mean, your book focuses, as we said in the introduction, on Russia, China, Venezuela and Egypt. Are there things that those four countries share that make them ripe for the sort of place that a dictatorship will thrive?
Well, yes. I mean, these regimes, they are working in a very hostile environment for dictatorship. I mean, if you understand that it's really never been harder to run a regime, an authoritarian regime, than it is today. There are more forces moving against you. media, satellite, human rights organizations, just the sheer dwindling number of these regimes. So if you're going to be able to pull it off, you need to have a particular architecture to your regime. And at root, what these regimes all have in common is it's about the centralization of power. So how do you do that in a way that is less offensive to people? How can you fine-tune your repression, if you will? And they do that by no longer really using mass arrests, firing squads, disappearances, sort of what we imagine when we say, when we think of a 20th century dictatorship. Rather, if Putin wants to squelch a group, he sends tax inspectors, he sends health inspectors to check their paperwork and shutter them. Media is predominantly controlled by the state, but they allow a few small publications to operate, usually print publications, so that they can get some idea of what's actually going on. They speak in the language of democracy. They even host human rights groups, even though they're the chief perpetrators of crime.
And so there's an idea that that the rebels wanting to undercut the dictatorship obviously behave in a certain way, act like rebels, act like pirates in a certain sense. The dictators themselves have to employ the tactics of the people that are trying to erode their own power, presumably.
Yes, I mean, what you end up with and what I describe in the book is sort of a active learning process between both sides, where one side innovates and comes up with new tactics or political strategies, and then the other side responds. And so it's a very dynamic struggle that's happening within these countries. And basically for the last 2 years, what I've done is I've traveled to each of these places, and in each place I would meet with people in the regime, people that serve the dictator, if you will, and talk to them, how is it that you do what you do? And at the same time, I would then meet with, you know, the somewhat more motley crew of environmentalists, activists, lawyers, academics, students, bloggers, who are challenging and trying to unseat the regime.
And presumably the fact that China, Russia, Egypt, Malaysia, Venezuela, the places you go in your book, the fact that some of the mandarins in the civil service there and in the political parties there, or lack of them, let you in and would talk to you for your book, presumably it is sort of balm to the vanity of your book. It proves your point that they're allowing people in to talk about it because they're trying to give the lie to the fact that they're dictatorships in the first place.
That's right. That's right. I mean, they're extreme. I mean, they invite you to lunch, in fact. You know, they're and their suits are always nicer than mine. You know, they're very sophisticated a lot. Most of them studied at universities right down the street from where I'm sitting right now, at Georgetown University or Johns Hopkins Sice and things like that. They are, you know, they were as schooled in American democracy as they are in their own political history. These are very savvy bunch. Now, you know, there's variation among them, no question, and you know they would critique each other. I met with members of the Chinese Communist Party 10 days after Mubarak fell, and they were, when I asked them about what they had witnessed in Egypt, they were very critical of it, and they said, well, I mean, first of all, who stays in power with one person in power for 30 years? Who does that anymore? I mean, they thought, they look at sort of some of the Middle Eastern examples as being rather crude compared to their own, where the Chinese Communist Party enforces the top leaders to change every two terms. They get two terms and then they get a new leader. That's not a law. That's a norm that they've enforced because they understand that it's a wise thing to do to change the face of the regime. In other places like Venezuela, yes, they would meet with me, but there was a much greater level of paranoia that was present. At every instance, without irony, I was always referred to as a member of the empire or a journalist from the empire or what have you. They would have the meetings, but they were never very comfortable about it.
And you talked about the Middle East, and obviously we've talked about Mubarak, who was the sort of, I always think of someone like Saddam Hussein possibly being the last of the sort of classic dictators, if you know what I mean, that used fairly unsubtle means to do his bidding.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, I mean, really, when it gets down to it right now, if there's really the poster child, if you will, it's North Korea.
I'm going to ask you to rank them, William, obviously. We're going to put some music behind it. No, I'm not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, North Korea is really, I mean, no one really wants to follow in that example. No one wants to be the next North Korea. You have others that have sort of were more sophisticated, but because they've faced challenges, have really resorted to the old techniques. Obviously, the chief one that we all have on our mind right now is Syria. I mean, Assad has really taken more of a page from his father's book. His father brutally crushed a rebellion in the early 1980s, killing more than 25,000 people in about the space of a month. This is clearly more what his son is doing, choosing violence as a means to try and crush this, rather than using the more sophisticated methods that we've seen even in the last year in places like Russia and Malaysia and Jordan, where the protesters were met by the regime by saying, you know what, you actually have a point. Let's try to work together. Now, they don't actually mean to bring forward genuine reform, but they understand that they can best stop up the dissent by at least appearing to be engaging with it.
And you're talking about these places and these leaders as if there's a sort of, as if everyone's talking with their sort of eyebrow raised and a knowing wink that everyone knows that this is what we're doing. I mean, when you're walking the corridors of power in those countries, is there the tacit acceptance that they know what you're there for really, but they're going to allow you to get on and write your book?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, sometimes I really honestly couldn't tell you. I don't really know. They have such a good poker face that it was hard to know. But there were some instances. I mean, I actually found myself through a bizarre set of circumstances in the Venezuelan National Assembly interviewing on the floor of their parliament building, if you will, one of the most rabid, ideologically driven Chavistas. She's more of a Chavista than Chavez, legislators. And she said, you know, I know what, you know, she just sort of called it out. I know what you're here for. And I know you're here just to, you know, collect some quotes to make us look bad and embarrass us and then go back to the empire to plan the invasion. And, you know, I mean, so in that instance, yes. I mean, she sort of said, you know, this is what I think. And you know, To be fair, my purpose was in every instance to say, look, you know, here's the thing we know. We know that it's very hard for one person to stay in power for so long, that there's certain infirmities that always exist. And yet, for a variety of different reasons, this regime or that regime is somehow being able to persist. What I want to do is I want to understand how. We can argue over whether or not these things are good or bad or what have you, but there is a how to it, and that's what we really need to understand.
All right, William Dobson, author of The Dictator's Learning Curve, fascinating stuff. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
This is Midori House. Now, Cannes Lions is the world's biggest annual awards show and festival for professionals in the world of creative communications. Once a byword for sun, celebration and champagne, the event seen as the Oscars of the advertising world is increasingly becoming a place where brands, agencies and creatives also go to master their trade and secure a good business relationship or two. This year, a record 11,000 delegates from around the world have descended on the monolithic Palais Festival Conference Centre on the sun-drenched Croisette along the coast in Cannes. Today marks the last day of talks and seminars, and we dispatched Katie Bilboa down there to find out what's been causing a stir this year. Away from the burning sunshine and the safety of the centre, she caught up with the chair of the festival, Terry Savage.
The heritage of Cannes Lions was, of course, based in advertising. We've morphed that into creativity, but the reality is that the bulk of the people attending Cannes during this week are communications specialists, either in the fields of creativity or marketers or designers, anyone that's really got an interface with people. And this year we have 11,000 delegates who spend a week in Cannes immersed in 50 seminars, 30 forums, 20 workshops. There's a huge level of content discussing all facets of the industry that are, of course, changing at incredible speed. So the need to learn, the need to understand are higher now than they've been probably at any time in history. And so people understand they've got to sit in those seminars, listen to the thought leaders in the industry to be relevant and to be able to emerge as future thought leaders in the industry.
And how much of it is about the seminars? How much of it is it about the awards? And how much is it just about bringing people together so they can meet each other and do business?
Well, I think it's a combination of all of those factors. But learning has really emerged in the last 5 years as being of critical importance to Cannes, because unless festivals like ours actually give something back in a very tangible way, they're not relevant.
And am I right in thinking there's a record number of attendees this year, a record number of delegates?
Yeah, this year is a record. The 11,000 has eclipsed the previous record in 2008, just before the crash of 2009. So the bounce back, in fact, has been very, very strong, as it has in entries.
Are they coming from traditional backgrounds? Is it because companies are bouncing back? Or are there new markets and new companies springing up in areas of the world that want to come to Cannes and be part of that community?
Well, again, I think it's a factor of all of those things. Certainly the traditional large, strong economies are coming in greater numbers. But, for example, we have 520 companies that have come to Cannes this year that have never come before. We have, for example, 47 people from Nigeria here this week, which is a staggering figure when you figure the size of the Nigerian advertising industry. We have people from China, from India, from Indonesia, Vietnam. And, of course, the emerging markets are the ones that really want to learn. And the reality today is the best work comes from everywhere.
And what's the kind of balance like between the big kind of multinational agencies and then the smaller homegrown creative talent? Do you find it's still the big names winning the prizes and coming up with the latest innovation? Or is there more room now for those smaller companies to come through?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, scale counts. So if you've got 120 offices and you've got sort of 1,200 entries, proportionally you're probably going to win more than if you've got 90 entries and two offices. But you do see smaller agencies that are rooted in creativity winning here and probably punching well above their weight, and that happens with some countries too. I mean, Australia wins a lot here comparative to the size of the country. New Zealand does very well here. Scale is obviously important, but great talent through the independent system always shines through at Cannes.
Are there any specific examples you can give of smaller projects that have really caught your eye this year that you've thought are really creative and really innovative?
There was a great winner in design, which was for the Austrian Solar Energy Commission, which was an annual report, which you can only see the print appear on the annual report when you exposed it to sunlight. I mean, I think that's an amazing execution from a very traditional thing, an annual report, and yet it was created in an incredibly innovative way. If I was sitting here 5 years ago, I would have said, well, look, I think the industry is struggling with digital. Doesn't quite get it, doesn't quite understand it. That certainly is not the case now. You can see the whole festival is emerged in digital. I think that's where you're seeing most of the innovation that is coming through at the festival this year.
And just looking at the bigger picture, how much weight do those traditional mediums still carry compared to the digital world now? So how important is getting something into a newspaper or on television or on radio compared to having a video online or getting some kind of viral campaign moving?
I think the first thing to say is the world doesn't move at the same speed. And so what's important in the UK or New York, or what's unimportant in the UK and New York perhaps, can still be very, very important in the Far East, in the Middle East. So, in fact, in those countries, some traditional media, such as print, are still continuing to grow. So I think if you actually take the real bottom line, is how many entries did we get this year in those particular categories? And, in fact, print grew. Now, that doesn't mean print sort of and newspapers and magazines are flying back into a new realm. They're not. But I think there is this fallacy that because it's happening in the big Western economies, it's happening all over the world, and that's certainly not the case. And as long as those countries are still in that phase, then print in a global event such as ours will continue to be important.
Do you think radio advertising, I mean, I think for a long time it's been seen as a bit staid and maybe something in the past. Do you see anything new and innovative in radio that's kind of catching your eye at the moment?
Radio is going through the same process as everything else. You're a web-based radio station. There will be innovations and changes in your business just like in all of the other businesses, but it will come down to two things. Have you got great content? Do people want to listen? Radio is a one-to-one medium. People in a car can't live without radio. I can't drive a car without listening to radio. I argue with my daughter which station it should be all the time, but so I think radio is really well placed for the future. In fact, our entries rose here to 1,700 84, I think it was, 31% increase. I think it's an interesting medium. I think it's an underutilised medium. I have a view as to why that is, and I think the radio industry needs to wake up to the fact that they should not be employing in-house copywriters, but should be employing the very best people in the industry, because great radio gets great sales, and great sales get great sales for the radio station. That's a business issue, but I think as a medium, most people involved in the creative sphere would say it's a very powerful one.
That was Terry Savage. We like him, don't we? He's the chair of the Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity, talking to Monocle's Katie Bilboa. And to hear Katie's full report from the festival, you better tune into my show Culture with Robert Bound at 1900 hours on Monday. There'll be loads of other great stuff in there too. Just you wait and see. I promise I didn't write that that back, I know. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking about why Zurich's so damn good. All this week on Midori House, we've been visiting the cities which the new Quality of Life issue of Monocle has deemed the world's most livable. And tonight, it's finally time to discuss the winner, Zurich. Joining me in the studio to discuss why Zurich works as a city is Zurich enthusiast and Monocle researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome.
Welcome. Hi, Rob.
And we're going to have on the line also Joe Furness, who's a Monocle contributor. Hi there, Joe.
Hi, Robert. Hi, Fernando.
Joe, we're going to start off with you. You can... Even if you're not looking out the window over a beautiful lake and some well-mannered streets and some sort of well-dressed people kind of quaffing a beer in the street, just imagine that you are. Set the scene for us in Zurich. Why did Monocle choose it as its most livable city?
Well, I imagine you've probably chosen it for lots of reasons. There's great architecture, there's the efficient transport system, all of these things. But I think the reason why it tops most people's list is because of the lifestyle. And as you said, on a beautiful, warm summer's evening like tonight, everyone's left their office and they're probably strolling by the river, or they're settling down at one of the pavement cafes for a coupli of champagne. Maybe they're even swimming in the lake. And there's a real sense here that we work hard, and so we have a right to enjoy life, and that's Zurich.
And you mentioned the working hard. A lot of people do associate the city with that sort of thing simply, don't they? They know that the trams run on time, they know that the trains run on time, they know that, I think there's a statistic, 77 people in the city work in finance. There's very much a sort of, people perhaps misassociate it with a work vibe. Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one thing that's quite unusual, it's almost a contradiction really about Zurich, is like you say, it's a city that's founded on finance, on taking business very, very seriously indeed. But people also really know how to have downtime. And things like, for example, nothing opens on a Sunday in Zurich. All the shops will be closed, and that is family time, that is private time. It's really sacrosanct. And so once the office door closes and people are strolling and going about their leisure time, that's very much valued as well.
All right, Joe, we'll stay on the line. I'm going to cross over to Fernando, who's sitting just opposite me here, who's a Zurich enthusiast. He's walked arm in arm, possibly, through the streets of Zurich. Fernando, give us a bit of a personal touch. I mean, one thing I've sort of, as much as I love the city, I've been there for Art Basel and various different things. I love its art scene and things, but it's damn difficult to get a drink, isn't it? And get a seat at a restaurant after 9 o'clock and stuff like this. The practical stuff that makes a city sexy and usable in a leisure way. How do you see it?
I mean, I agree, but I think Zurich has quite an all right nightlife. I remember there's a neighborhood called Niederdorf, and they have some bars that are open until late. And I remember, I mean, every time I went there, I had an ice-cold panache, which is like a shandy, but better, I have to say.
Yes, it's a panache, isn't it? Yeah, I love the name of that for a drink.
And it's so good, you know. I don't know what's the secret, but it's better than shandy, you know. But it's and it's lovely, and they have thousands of little bars where you can have your roasty. I mean, I love roasty, and mm-hmm. I know it's a cliche, but I love Swiss food. You know, I love chocolate roasty, all those.
I love all that stuff as well.
Raclette.
Entirely on dairy myself.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. It's amazing.
And panache.
Oh yeah.
Man cannot live on panache
and
alone.
Overmaltine as well. That's one of my favorites.
But do you think you need a bit of a cultural compass to negotiate the streets of Zurich? Is it a difficult mistress? Does it give up its charm slowly?
Well, I think so. And you know, the Swiss, they can be quite discreet and reserved. But once you get to know them as well, you know, they're great. I mean, I have lots of experience with them. And you're talking
you
about...
You just blush.
Sorry.
Well, maybe we'll go to, we'll speak to Joe. Joe, I wonder what the, when you think of the sort of some of the pillars of what makes Zurich great, what would you say they are, obviously working as a as an expat working in Zurich? What are the things that you don't miss about home that you find wonderful in Zurich?
I think what I love most about Zurich is that there's all, you're always close to nature. I mean, it's a very small city, as you know. It's only, I think there's less than 400,000 people here, which I think in most other countries would be considered a town. And so it's a very small space. It's very easy to navigate in that sense. But because it's Switzerland's main city, biggest city, it's got all of the attractions that you would expect, but within this confined space. But the nature is all around you. Obviously, there's the lake that the city is sort of gathered around the lake. There's two beautiful rivers that run through the city, which are clean enough to people say they're clean enough to drink, but they're certainly clean enough to swim in. And that's what everyone will be doing tonight. Everyone will be, you know, having their grills next to the river and swimming. Or you can sort of climb up one of the little hills that surround the city and go hiking in the Wanderwegs, in the walking routes. Go up to the Utliberg maybe and have a longer view all the way over to the Alps. And again, it comes down to lifestyle. The Swiss people, they're outside all of the time. They love their nature. They respect it and they use it all the time.
And I mean, obviously, Zurich's has become a very international city because of its sort of banking industry. Is that something? I mean, is that to its advantage, do you think, or is it the right sort of foreigners that are in Zurich, if you know what I mean, or is it very much? And this is perhaps is another criticism that it might be just a sort of superstrata of financiers, and then they're cleaners that live there.
Well, touching on your point about it being an international city, there's something like, I think it's 30% foreign people, expats, live in Zurich, so it is a very international city. And one of the main criticisms I hear about it is that the average person, whether that's the average expat or the average Swiss person, frankly can't afford to live there. Rents are just so high. It is a small city. Housing stock is very small. And most people, particularly families, just can't go there. It's a city really that's full in terms of people living there, full of young people and sort of quite well-heeled older people. But there's just no space for families.
We're going to have to wind it up there, but enjoy your evening lakeside. And thank you very much also, Fernando, for giving
us
a personal touch. That was Joe Furness live from Zurich and Fernando, and you're listening to Midori House. We're going to meet the neighbours next. It's Friday, which means it's time now to stroll around and meet one of Monocle's lovely neighbours. Today, we visited the Atlas Gallery, the photographer's gallery, just on the corner, and we spoke to director and owner Ben Burdett about how and why the gallery succeeds and its latest installation.
My name's Ben Burdett. I'm the director of the Atlas Gallery in Marylebone. We're located on the corner of Chiltern and Dorset Street. The Atlas Gallery has been established for almost 18 years, although we've actually only been in this location for 10. We spent about 5 years in Shoreditch. Prior to that, we were actually based the other side of Marylebone High Street. We've been based in Marylebone off and on since the company was founded in 1994. And we are a gallery specializing exclusively in photography, which includes both fine art photography, photojournalism, fashion, contemporary photography. We have a big contemporary exhibition on at the moment, which is a mixed show. We deal with all aspects, really, of the photographic medium. And that's really what we've been specializing in and building our reputation on. We've got some great names here. Probably the best known photographer on the wall at the moment is a photographer whose name's Jim Goldberg, who won the big photography prize, the Cartier-Bresson Award, in 2009. And we've got a major piece from the series that won that award, which is a collage made up of newsprint shot in Somalia, which is a really important work. We've also got four other photographers who are new to Atlas. They're new photographers, and they've never exhibited in London before, although they're all considerably sort of well-known and well-collected photographers. So we've got an Italian photographer whose name is Oliver Barbieri, who does fantastic sort of overhead, almost kind of unreal photographs of landscapes, cities. In the case of the piece we've got here, it's a seascape of a beach. And all his work looks kind of almost unreal. The photographs are always shot using a technique which makes the scene almost look like a kind of architect's model. They're quite interesting. What I like about Marylebone, I think, is the fact that it just looks like nowhere else. I've been here a long time and I've seen it change, but it's got a lot of character which goes sort of just beyond the shop front. There's a very kind of sort of almost sort of residential community here which goes back a long time, and you know, there's a sense of continuity here which I really like.
That was the director and owner of the Atlas Gallery, Ben Burdett. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Up next after the news, it's Marcus Hippie's Menu. And on tomorrow's review at midday, Gillian DeBias will be guiding us through some new disco music played by Mr. Pinks and Mr. Thomas Weaver. Editor of AA Magazine will be flicking through a stack of his favourite architecture titles. Midori House will be back on Monday. I'm Robert Bound. Thanks for listening.